This podcast sponsored by Cherry Hill Volvo.
At Cherry Hill Volvo, we have absolutely incredible offers, and a plethora of both new and certified Volvos from which to choose. Join Cherry Hill Volvo for the pricing and attention you deserve. I am Judith Krupnik, president of Cherry Hill Volvo.
Hi, I'm Lauren Sherman, the host of Fashion People. I love fashion, obviously, but shopping for fashion online is kind of annoying. There's endless scrolling, my size is always out of stock, and I can't actually find what I want. No one has really made this work for me. That is until List. Instead of browsing different stores one by one, on List you can see and shop all of the best fashion. List is the secret shopping weapon now used by all my most stylish, cool, and in-the-know friends. Don't shop around. Join 200 million fashion shoppers, including me, on List.com. That's L-Y-S-T. Or download the List app on the App Store today.
So 2 minutes.
Okay. 2 minute countdown.
2 minutes.
2 minutes of showtime. All right.
So you usually have another show right now? Is that what you usually have something else going on? Is that what I gathered from the tweet?
Oh, so I've been doing the 5 p.m. local show.
Oh, wow.
But I had a bad migraine all day. So I figured I would just skip it and rest for a little while so I could make sure I was on my game tonight, you know?
Oh, man, you feel okay?
Yeah, I feel better. I get these like twice a year and they're brutal, you know?
Painful.
I think it's a genetic thing. Like my mom gets them, so. But I'm good now.
Nice, now you got the hat, the superpower hat.
Got the shield, we're ready to go.
Nice. That's awesome.
We're gonna make Joe Rogan envious.
That's right, he's probably watching.
1 minute, I'll let you know when we're there.
All right.
He's lighting cigars with $1,000 bills.
Man, unbelievable, right? Holy cow, $100 million, man. Damn, what are we doing wrong?
Not bad.
Man. You're gonna be cashing it in now that you got a TV show.
Yeah, it's not as much as one would think. Like they pretty much closed all the loopholes for authors along the way when people like got proceeds from Star Wars figures and, you know, Rambo lunchboxes that no one ever thought would be anything in the original deal. Well, they've tightened those up over the years. That's just how it works, you know? So the last guys to have really great timing, I think, were John Grisham and Michael Crichton. I think those guys got the kind of the tail end of when authors could really...
And James Patterson?
Yeah, I think he just has so many. Yeah, he was in that time frame too with the Alex Cross stuff. So he's probably sure his did, yeah, exceptionally well. But they tightened that up a little bit. The lawyers get in there and everybody's managers and all that stuff, and they just close those off when they see one that spikes for somebody else that doesn't benefit, then they close it off.
Right.
All right, I'm going to try it now. I'll tell you when you guys are actually on Facebook. I'm going to make sure this works. Think you are.
Yep, mine says webinar is now streaming live on Facebook.
That's what it says.
There you go.
Yeah.
You're on.
All right, I think we're hot. All right, welcome to our virtual speaker series with Navy SEAL, best-selling author, and now TV star, Jack Carr. It's me, Rich Zioli. Happy to have you with us tonight, hanging out at home, watching this. Thank you for being here with us. Before we get started, I just want to say a quick thank you to our sponsors tonight. Garden State Earthworks, my buddy Lou Vargo, they do great work. They waterproof your yard, completely drain the water away, and their hardscaping division, amazing stuff with the patios. They built me a gorgeous, beautiful patio. So if you're gonna be hanging out all summer, might as well enjoy your backyard, and Garden State Earthworks can deliver for you in a big, big way. Go to gardenstateearthworks.com. Also wanna thank Malamud and Associate Attorneys at Law, outstanding legal representation. They're there for you every step of the way. They're huge supporters of Talk Radio 1210 WPHT. They sponsor our studio. So when you need an attorney, think Malamud & Associates Attorney at Law. Make them your first call for all kinds of different needs, especially when it comes to workers' comp issues and it comes to accident claims. So reach out to them, Malamud & Associates Attorneys at Law, LLC. We're so happy tonight to welcome back our second time with the man himself, Jack Carr. Jack, how you doing, buddy?
Great. How's it going? I always love talking to you.
This is fun, man. It was so great because, you know, your book comes out. We talked last year about, all right, we're definitely going to do an event together. But then my wife got pregnant, so the baby was due this, like almost the same day that the book was coming out. And then, so we couldn't do it. And then all of a sudden, you know, this started. So we just said, all right, let's just do it virtually. Why not? Everybody else is doing it that way.
Absolutely. You got to adapt. That's what life is all about. And you know who else did some adapting today on Facebook? I saw that Sylvester Stallone is watching Rocky with everybody else, doing a free showing of Rocky on Facebook Live. And you know, that's wow, your talent right there, running the steps and the whole deal. So
we're competing with Rocky tonight.
Time I was out there visiting you, I wanted to do that. And I didn't realize that where we had our event last time was not right there in the city. It was a little bit outside of town there. So I couldn't run those steps, but I saw that Stallone was doing that today. And I was tempted to tune in, but I had to work on book four. So
that's I understand. And I can't wait to talk about book four because I think it's very relevant to everything that's going on here. So first of all, for people that don't know Jack, he's always wanted to be an author. That's the cool thing about this is that even when you were a Navy SEAL, it was always not something you thought about doing, not something you wanted to try, not like a hobby. You were dead set on becoming an author, actually really since you were a kid, right?
Yep, both those things with the same amount of passion for each. And just being a Navy SEAL had to come first. And then I was going to write fiction in this genre. So those are the two things I wanted to do from my earliest memories. I can't remember ever wanting to do anything else. But it wasn't like I was using one for a stepping stone to the other or anything like that. It was just first I'm going to serve my country in uniform as a SEAL. Then I'm going to write fiction in this genre. So that's was always in my head from when I was 7 years old is when I found out about SEALs. And wow, then as I transitioned to reading the same kind of books that my parents were reading, which is about fifth grade when Hunt for Red October came out, and I'm reading guys like Nelson DeMille and David Morrell and AJ Quinnell, JC Pollock, Mark Olden, all these guys in the 80s who had protagonists that had backgrounds that I wanted to have in real life one day. So I just loved reading those books, and I knew that one day I would write fiction just like those guys. So as I got ready to get out of the military, I just switched gears and said, okay, in my head, I said, I am now an author and now I write.
And now you write, now you're New York Times bestselling author, which is pretty amazing, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's so crazy, it's so surreal. I think it's still sinking in because you see it on all those books that I just, by those guys I just mentioned, growing up, you'd see that across the top, you know, David Morrell, Brotherhood of the Rose, New York Times bestselling author, Nelson DeMille, Charm School, New York Times bestselling author. Like you'd see that it was just on all those guys, all those books that I read. And so now they sent me what the new books are going to look like when they come out, and they're all going to have that on the top. So it's kind of crazy. And I feel so fortunate because what we're going to talk about later, none of those announcements, the Pratt announcement with Amazon, the Joe Rogan podcast, like those big announcements that tap into huge audiences, didn't happen until after this third book came out. So really the reason it's on the New York Times bestseller list is because of word of mouth from readers who took a risk on an unknown author, enjoyed the novel and told a friend. Like that's how this happened. That makes it extremely special for me.
Well, I know the Zioli Army was all over it buying books, yeah, telling their friends, and they were, you know, when you came on the show a couple weeks ago, New York Times bestseller list right after that. So we'll take a, you know, we'll do a little.
I think that was it. That pushed me right over the edge.
I mean, it doesn't hurt. All right. So Chris Pratt is one of my favorite actors. I love the guy. He's just great in everything. He's a man of very, very deep spiritual beliefs. He's a Christian. He's kind of a libertarian, conservative kind of guy. I mean, he got in a little bit of trouble for wearing a Gadsden flag, which is, you know, the don't tread on me. I mean, it was so silly, the controversy around that. He's a great guy and he's super talented. And how did he discover your book?
Yeah, so it's crazy because as I was writing it, and I think if you read a lot of these books, like the how-to books on how to write or how to get published or that sort of thing, I think they tell you not to picture an actor, a specific actor playing your character.
Right.
But for a child of the 80s, that was next to impossible for me not to do. So as I was writing, I kind of thought about, hey, I need a likable character because this guy in the terminal list, this former Navy SEAL sniper who becomes an officer and then gets wrapped up in this conspiracy, he's going to have to do some pretty horrible things to people. And I'm going to need the reader. And if it becomes a TV series or a movie, I'm going to need the viewer to be able to forgive him, to be invested in that character enough that when he does these horrible things, they're still on his side. And they don't put that book down or turn that channel or leave the movie theater. And I thought, you know, I need someone likable. And I thought, okay, who is so, Chris Pratt, he is a likable guy. And he had just, it was weird because at the time he'd only done Parks and Rec. He hadn't yet done Passengers and hadn't had any of the huge success that he's had now with Jurassic Park and Guardians of the Galaxy. He was just the guy on Parks and Rec. And he had a very small role in Zero Dark Thirty, where he played a SEAL. And I thought back to Tom Hanks in the 80s, playing all those funny roles from Bosom Buddies to Joe versus the Volcano. And then he took that risk with Philadelphia in the early 90s. And that really, then he became one of the best actors of his generation. He could choose all his projects from then on out. And I thought, who's that guy that needs to take that step, needs to do something that's a little grittier, a little outside his comfort zone maybe, but is still a likable guy? That's Chris Pratt. And so that's who I wrote, thought of in my head as playing the character as I wrote that first novel. And then before that first one came out, so in the fall of 2017, a buddy from the SEAL teams called me that I hadn't talked to in 5 or 6 years and pick up and we start talking. And he says, hey, you know, I always wanted to thank you for what you did for me as I was leaving the SEAL teams. And in my head, I'm thinking, did I bail him out of jail? What did I do? And he's like, yeah, you just sat me down and we talked about transition. You introduced me to some people in the private sector. And I always appreciated that. You're the only one that did that. And I always wanted to thank you. And I was like, hey, no problem. And then he said, hey, I heard you wrote a book. And I said, yeah, it's coming out in a few months. I have these galley copy things that are early editions and I'd love to send you one. And he said, yeah, that'd be great. But I'd love it if you could send me another one. I could give to a friend of mine. I said, no problem. Yeah. Who's your friend? And I said, Chris Pratt.
Wow.
Oh, okay. Funny you should mention that because as I was writing this thing, that's who I pictured. So I sent it to my buddy, Jared Shaw, awesome guy. And then he gave it to Chris and Chris read it on a flight over to, I think they were on their way to London for some, they were a premiere or a film festival or something, but I have pictures of him reading that galley copy for the first time on that private plane to London. So yeah, very cool.
Wow.
He reached out a couple weeks later and said he wanted to buy it. So I said, okay.
So you pictured Chris Pratt and then Chris Pratt becomes the guy.
Yep. And even stranger than that is that I pictured Anton Fuqua directing. And he did Training Day, Tears of the Sun, Magnificent Seven, Equalizer, Shooter with Mark Wahlberg based on the Point of Impact novel by Stephen Hunter. And I pictured him directing and now he's directing. So it's just so crazy how all that has just come full circle and that they're working on it together. And I got to advise on the pilot script, which is awesome. I'm so excited the direction they're taking it. And then now we have the writer's room together and we're putting together the rest of the script. So it's, I think it's an 8-episode thing right now. And then we'll see where it goes from there, but it's all based on the first novel. So I think it's a great way to tell the story.
Do you believe that if you envision something, if you believe in something enough that it will come true, is that kind of something that guides you, Jack?
I think if you were just to sit there and that's the only thing you did, it's probably not going to work out for you. Like if you just sit in the room and just hope that these good things will come your way, like that's probably not the way to go.
Right.
But it's certainly an element that continues to drive you forward if you're doing the work and just helps you be a more pleasant person. You know, if you envision these things happening that you want to happen and you do everything you possibly can to set yourself up for success if that opportunity arises. Mm-hmm. So that's the key part, is being ready to go, because if opportunity knocks and you're not ready, well, then you're done. So you have to have that piece in place. You have to have that work done. Kind of with that first book, I was going to get one shot of someone opening that up at Simon & Schuster and reading that first line. And I could have had that opportunity and then not have done that work, not put all that effort in, or said, oh, geez, I have this, hold on. Now I'm going to go write it real quick. They said they want it, let me, no. Like it had to be ready, the timing had to be right. You had to be prepared by putting in that work ahead of time so that when the door cracked open at Simon & Schuster, I was ready to send that manuscript off. They liked it, and bam, off you go to the races from there. But all those elements have to be in place, I think.
By the way, if you're watching on Facebook Live right now, you can ask a question to us and ask a question to Jack. First question is, who's gonna play me in the movie? Which we'll talk about. That's going to really be season 2, I think, on Amazon, really, because, you know, season 1's almost done. So we'll get to that. But you can ask a question to Jack Carr, of course, as we go through the night tonight. We're just happy you're joining us tonight. All right. So this Amazon series based on Terminal List, your first book in this trilogy now, Chris Pratt's behind it. So is he playing the main character, and he's also the guy behind like the production, the producer, and that sort of thing.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So he's starring as James Reese, former Navy SEAL sniper turned officer. And so he's playing the main role.
Amazing.
And so his, I guess it's his production company, or however they structure things in all that. I'm not sure. I don't ask too many questions like that, cause I'm just happy to be here. You know, I don't want right. to, so I'm just kind of learning as I go, but yeah, so he's in charge. He owns it, owns the character and is playing him in the series.
You've got three kids, right, Jack?
Yep. Yep, three little ones that might come bursting in any minute. So
mine too. I got a 5-year-old, a 3-year-old, and a 1-month-old. It's very possible they might come in. I can see them over there. Hi, guys. I see them over there. How old are your kids, Jack?
So we have 14, 12, and 9.
All right, so they're a little bit older, so they can kind of entertain themselves. But still, I mean, how do you find the time to write? You're obviously dedicated to your family, dedicated to your wife and your kids. And a lot of times, like I know last time, you were in Alaska. You were writing Savage Son, and I believe you were camped out in Alaska, right? Trying to focus yourself and focus on that. How do you manage all that?
Well, it's crazy now that there's not any dedicated time that the kids have to be away from the house. Now they are here, right, as am I. So as I was writing downstairs just before I jumped on this, they're outside, right outside the door, the guest room downstairs where I'm writing is a pool table, ping pong table, the Peloton thing. So I just hear all of them, like, why everywhere I go in this house, they follow. Like, why is this happening? It's like a magnet. Like, I need quiet. Right. I need quiet to write. Like, I can just stare at a blank wall. If it's quiet, that's great. You know, I don't need the view. It's a beautiful view here at the mountains. I can't get anything done in this office with this beautiful view and the books and everything. I have to go someplace where it's quiet. So typically before all this happened, I go to the local library, just somewhere where I'm not going to be interrupted. The interruptions are really what kill you. But that's not possible right now. So it's been a challenge trying to figure out when to write. Typically it's later at night when finally everyone's gone down for the night. I can take a breath. There's no phone calls, there's no emails coming in. And that's typically when I wrote the first two as well, really late at night. I was hoping to get a little more sleep these days for this fourth one, but with COVID-19, that has not been possible. So it's crazy, but you gotta make the time, gotta figure it out and make it happen. And then the lead up to this, it was crazy because it was book launch was April 14th, which was probably the height of the hysteria surrounding the pandemic. Like that week was probably the worst week to launch anything. And I saw that as we got closer, like, hey, there's not going to be a traditional book tour. I was well poised with the plan to make the New York Times list in a normal type of year, but no one knew what was going to happen. Were people going to spend money? Were they not? What's going to be going on? There's no book tour. How's that going to impact? Simon & Schuster couldn't look back to say, oh, in the pandemic of 89, this is what happened. Like there's nothing to look against. There's no playbook for us. You had to make it up as you went along. So you had to adapt just like for anything in life. So adapted by doing these virtual book signings, did that on a bunch of different platforms. I tried to push as much traffic as I possibly could towards independent bookstores, because even if they didn't have foot traffic, they were still open to ship, just like you could through Amazon. So I made up these limited edition book plates that you could only get through them, and just try to do everything I could to adapt to this changing environment and launch the book, and it ended up working out.
Let's go to your Navy SEAL days for a second, because I know that you were a sniper, right? And that's badass. I mean, there's no question about that. And I think, you know, we conjure up a lot of images in it. Your guy of the 80s, part of what I love about your books, Jack, is there's always these little 80s references in there. You know, there's a lot of little Easter eggs in there that just, it makes you smile because you go, oh yeah, this is like very nostalgic, you know? In the 80s, there weren't a lot of movies about Navy SEALs. There weren't any shows, anything like that. You mentioned some of the books, but in terms of Navy SEALs being portrayed on the big screen in Hollywood, when did that really start, you think?
So I'm trying to think if there was one before Navy SEALs with Charlie Sheen and Michael Biehn in, I think, 1990 is when that one came out. So that was titled U.S. Navy SEALs, or Navy SEALs was the name of that movie. And I'm trying to think if there was one before that, even if it was a small type of, and I'm not sure if there was, a lot more in fiction. Tom Clancy, of course, had John Clark, John Kelly. And I think seals were mentioned for the first time in fiction in Raise the Titanic by Clive Cussler. And that was in the late 70s. But I read about them first in Brotherhood of the Rose by David Morrell, who created Rambo back in 1972. But I remember the sentence that, there's only one sentence in that book that mentions seals, but it was such a strong, it was a sentence that cemented to me that I was on the right path. And it's just, and now I know David Morrell, we're great friends now, and he's such a fantastic guy, great author. But yeah, movies with Navy SEALs in them, you know, we had Commando, which was just a nebulous, you know, Commando, special operations guy. Of course, we had the second Rambo movie come out, Rambo First Blood Part 2.
I remember Delta Force with Chuck Norris. Delta that Force one stands out, awesome. Right?
Yeah,
that was a great movie.
The first part of that movie is actually fairly legit in that it's it draws on a real hijacking, like how the terrorists got on board, what happened once they were on board, separating the passengers, bringing people with Israeli passports to a separate section of the plane. They murdered a U.S. Navy diver who had his ID card, left him on the tarmac. So all that happens in the movie, and then it gets fictionalized from there. But that first half is actually fairly legit as recreating one of the terrorist incidents in the 80s. I think I'd read also in the nonfiction book in the Delta Force by Charlie Beckwith, who's the first commanding officer of Delta Force. He wrote a book, which I think came out in 86. And I think he mentioned SEALs in there as well. And Richard Marcinko's book came out in 91 or 92. And of course, I was super excited when that book came out, because now you have a guy that had been in Vietnam, had started this anti-terrorist heart of the SEAL teams, and now he has a book out. So I was at that age where I knew I was going there. I think I was 18 or 19. So I just devoured that, and that just once again, just I was reading everything I possibly could on the SEAL teams to prepare myself. Always been a student of history, student of warfare, always studying terrorism, insurgencies, counterinsurgencies, even before my time in the military. So really, when I got out, that foundation was built. I had those guys I mentioned earlier, those authors had provided me with my early education in the art of storytelling. So I knew what I liked, what worked, what didn't. And then I added to that study of warfare. And then after I got into the SEAL teams and after September 11th and went to Iraq and Afghanistan, then I got that practical experience downrange that I could then add to the mix. So as I went out, I can't think really of a better foundation from which to move into writing, especially if it's something one is passionate about, which obviously I am.
Yeah. So did you, like, being a Navy SEAL, by the way, I should mention too, that you can get a signed copy of Jack's book, Savage Son. There's a link you're going to see right there. Just click on that link right there, and then you'll be able to get the copy of the book, Savage Son, signed copy from the man himself, Jack Carr. You'll see the link to buy the books in the description on the video. And if you order one, you're going to get, you know, a signed nameplate from Jack, which is really, really cool. I was asked if I could show my mullet. I'm not showing my mullet. I cut my hair by myself, and I'm definitely not showing the mullet. Jack's rocking the beard, though. But I think you're rocking the beard because that's part of the persona, right?
I mean, if you go back in my Instagram, and I think I'm going to post one tomorrow, too, which is at Jack Carr USA. There's a picture of me from Alaska before I went into the SEAL team. So I think it's 1995, and got the full-on rocking the beard. I was early in on the beard stuff. Maybe it's those Chuck Norris movies in the 80s. That's a distinct possibility. Because in 95, yeah, like, young people just didn't have beards. It wasn't a thing back right then. But I was all in, and then went to the SEAL teams. And then as soon as I could get a beard back, which was after September 11th, I went all in again. So I think I'm posting one of those tomorrow, another picture from my time in Alaska, which also informs this third novel, Savage Son. There's a conversation that the characters are having at this dinner, and they refer back to its time when James Reese, the protagonist, goes into the wilderness in Alaska by himself, and they make some jokes about what he did back going into the wilderness before there were cell phones and sat phones and all the rest of it. So I draw on that experience and weave it into the storyline as well.
Very cool. Very cool. Now, becoming a Navy SEAL, was that the goal, was to become a SEAL of all the different things you could have done?
Yep. So yep. I always wanted to do that. I found out about SEALs when I was seven. And back then we'd watch Sunday football, but I wasn't really interested in football. I was interested in the movie because there was ABC, CBS, NBC, and that one weird outlier channel that was always playing a black and white war movie. So I would wait for the commercials and my dad would say go and look at his watch, and I'd run up because I was the remote control, and I'd change the channel to that one weird outlier, and I'd sit down and watch whatever they were watching, whatever they were playing, for 2 minutes. And then my dad would be like, change it back. I'd change it back, and then I'd wait for the next commercial. But one of those was the Frogmen. And it showed these guys in black and white, and they were going up over the beaches in World War II and planting these explosives on these obstacles in advance of conventional force landings. And I just thought that was so cool. And I asked my dad, hey, who are these guys? And he said, those are frogmen. And I'm like, well, tell me more about these guys. This looks awesome. And he's like, nope, football, back, turn it back to football. Go ask your mom. So my mom was a librarian, and we went down and did some research at the local library on special operations, on SEALs, on frogmen. And I found out about that SEALs were touted as some of the most elite fighting force in the world, and the training was some of the toughest ever devised by a modern military. So I was like, that's it. That's where I'm going. But even before that, I knew I was going in the military because I grew up around, my grandfather was killed in World War II. And he flew the Corsair, which was the plane that had the gull wings that would fold up. It was highlighted in the TV show Black Sheep Squadron back in the late 70s, early 80s with Robert Conrad. And I grew up with the silk maps they used to give aviators back then, because if you hit the water with a paper map, it would disintegrate. So the maps were all silk. The American flag that my grandmother got, his medals, black and white photos of him with his plane and his squadron. So I just grew up with the idea of him as my hero. And I knew that one day I would follow his footsteps into the military. Just didn't know exactly what that was going to be, but something always drew me to that base primal, like land combat. I pretty much knew that I was going to do something that wasn't going to drive a ship. I wasn't going to fly a plane. I was going to do something that was that more visceral and primal. I've always been drawn to the outdoors. And so I knew I was going special operations, and then I found out about SEALs, and that was it. So just stayed focused on that goal until I got to BUDS and through BUDS and into the teams, and then always tried to continually improve myself, which we all try to do, and make myself the best operator and the best combat leader I possibly could. And then all that, I think, weaves its way into the storylines of the novel as well, which I think made it stand out to Simon and Schuster, who sees thousands of these things every year. So when they saw mine, I think what made it stand out is that I took those emotions and feelings behind things I've been involved with downrange, and then I applied those to a fictional narrative. So if people read it and it feels like what the protagonist is experiencing is real and visceral and authentic and raw, it's because they come from a real place. And all those things are true. They come from things that happen downrange, although the story's complete fiction.
Well, you say it is. And you actually had to get, of course, approval from the DOD, right? Mm-hmm. Everything had to be approved. And You mentioned last time we were together, Jack, that process was a gigantic pain in the ass, right? I mean, it took forever, and it was just not easy to deal with.
Such a pain. So I wanted to just try and do the right thing, you know, submit it. The first one, they only took 45 days, and they say 30, like what you sign says 30 days. First one was 45, and I thought that was fantastic for the gigantic bureaucracy. They took out 9 lines, which didn't really affect the storyline at all. It was ridiculous what they took out, because it's all not just public knowledge, but publicly available from the government itself. So the second one I submitted, and they took a lot longer. 1 month went by, then 2, then 3, then 4, then 5, then 6. And we had to push publication date from April into July, which was not ideal for someone at this stage of my writing career. It would have been much better to come out in April, but we had to push it. So got those redactions back, and they were like, I think 54 redactions, and they were so ridiculous. So this time I appealed. So you have a year to appeal, and I appealed, and I won 37 of those 54 on appeal. Meaning in the paperback, if people get the paperback edition, then and if they have the hardback also, they can compare what I won on appeal with what's taken out in the hardback. So you can see what didn't want you to see. And it's absolutely ridiculous though, what's been taken out. And what my lawyers do is they tie everything taken out to a publicly available government document, not just something on Wikipedia or something another SEAL wrote. They all tie back to something available from the government. And even with that, I only won 37 of the 54. So wow. It's totally ridiculous.
But what is that process? I mean, this is a fiction, the book is fiction. You're not telling a real story of something. So what exactly are they blocking out?
Well, I'll say what I want on appeal. So this, the second one, True Believer, it made sense for the protagonist. He starts off kind of on this journey and he ends up in Africa, spends some time there learning to live again. The second one is really a story of redemption, of violent redemption. And then he has to go somewhere to kind of get his skills up to the neck to where they used to be so that he can go and complete this mission from the government once they track him down. And so from where he is in Mozambique, just looking at the map, I was like, okay, he needs to go somewhere. He needs to be kind of a government-sponsored, shady CIA type place. Where would that be? Oh, here, this country out here, Morocco. So I'd been to Morocco and not in uniform before I went into the military. I'd never done anything there while in uniform, never talked to anyone that had done anything in Morocco as part of the military or as part of an intelligence agency. So I just made up a CIA black site in Morocco. Well, everything about Morocco came back blacked out. Fed Morocco, anything that had reference to their intelligence services, Moorish architecture they took out, Atlas Mountains in the distance they took out, like totally ridiculous. And I won those on appeal, so those are in the novel. But they take out weird, random, not really random things, but things that are like everyone already knows and that's out there from the government itself. They're kind of justifying their jobs with the black pen. And are very liberal with that taxpayer-supplied black pen. So this third one I submitted as well. So still trying to do the right thing, submit. Once again, these months start ticking by. And it's like, oh, geez, I'm going to have to push this publication date again. Oh, my gosh. So finally get it back. And then once again, go to appeal. And they wrote back and said they won't honor the appeal. So we're like, all right, I guess this is them telling me to stop doing it. So I'm going to take that as... I don't have to do this again because it's fiction, it's ridiculous. And yeah, I'm gonna take that letter saying that they won't let me appeal to say, okay, we don't need you to do this anymore.
But I think that's what makes, the books are awesome. They're so gripping and I love, you just keep turning the page and it's like, I gotta go to bed because I gotta get up at 4 a.m. to do a radio show. But I wanna read just, a couple more pages, but then every chapter ends with a cliffhanger and I gotta keep going. And all right, so James Reese, by the way, sometimes I call him Kyle Reese because I'm also a child of the 80s. Was there a thing with that?
You know, there's some stuff I keep private as to why I chose the names that I did. And I don't think, I wasn't really thinking Terminator when I came up with the name because it relates to something else personal in my life. So yeah. But it's just a cool name, I thought.
Oh, it's a great, it's a really cool name. Now he's conflicted a lot. I mean, there's what I love is that the conflict between, and this is really something unique, right? You go to serve your country, but you're really serving the Constitution, liberty, the Bill of Rights. And you've got to deal with a government that doesn't always protect that, right? So sometimes they're the biggest enemy. And you address that in your books. I mean, you talk about the notion of, and I heard you on the Joe Rogan podcast, I mean, talking about Three Felonies a Day, which is a book that I reference all the time.
Oh, nice. It's a great book. I give that away all the time. It's one of my most gifted books.
Because there's so many laws and there's so many regulations. And so the average American is breaking three laws a day that they don't even realize that they're breaking. And I think that sometimes, the stereotype, and what I love about your books is that the characters are not stereotypical. So James Reese is not a stereotypical guy who's like, I'm going to bring the American flag up the mountain and, everything America does is right. I mean, he's pointing out this constant give and take between our government and our country,
Yep. No, he's thoughtful. So when people ask me about the violence in the books and that sort of thing, I think of it as thoughtful violence. And, we're not in the SEAL teams are not just kind of robots that go in and, we're not a lot of us aren't how we're portrayed in the media or in other movies or that sort of thing. But James Reese is he's a thinking man's warrior. And is illustrated very early on in the first book where a police officer walks through the home in his office after his, I don't think this is a spoiler because I think it says it on the back jacket of the book. His family is killed, and a police investigator is walking through and is looking at the books on the bookshelf. And I write down some of the books that are on these bookshelves here. So a lot of that research that I did growing up, like all those things are now coming into play in these novels, and I'm weaving those into the storylines. But yeah, it's something that I am very passionate about is freedom, is liberty, is our constitution. And I want to pass on a country to my kids and grandkids that gives them the same options and opportunities that were given to me. And those were given to me by people who, from the inception of this country up until today, have shed blood for it. I want them to realize that it's a gift we've been given. We've been entrusted with that, and we need to pass that on to the next generation so they have those same options and opportunities that we had. And I think about that a lot. I thought about that a lot in Buds, actually, because I was going through Hell Week, and I thought, you know what? I'm on the beach here in Southern California. Yeah, we've been up for 5 days, and we got these boats on our heads. We're getting yelled at. We're on the verge of hypothermia. 80% of the classes quit. But I thought, you know what? This is not like storming the beaches at Normandy. This is not like Iwo Jima. This is not like what those people back in Revolutionary War days sacrificed to allow me to be on this beach pursuing my dream that I've wanted to do since I was 7 years old. And plus, I've been telling everybody since I was 7, I wanted to be a SEAL, and I can't very well go home right. Having quit after all those years. But I thought about all those things. But the most powerful one was thinking about what other people had sacrificed to give me the freedom to be there on that beach. So I do weave that in. And if you read the preface to all my novels, and actually the last few months, people have been highlighting this part right here and have been putting it on Facebook and putting it on Instagram, Twitter, all that stuff. And I write, as a free people, keeping federal power in check is something that should be of concern to us all. The fundamental value of freedom is what sets us apart from the rest of the world. We are citizens, not subjects, and we must stay ever vigilant that we remain so. So people have been taking that and putting
it. I love that. That's awesome.
Yeah, I wrote that.
It gives me chills.
Ah, thank you. I wrote that in August 6, 2017. So, but very apropos today, of course, with as we see some of these freedoms being encroached upon by the federal government, I'll say, and state governments.
All the time. You know, it's funny because the last speaker series we did before all this, it was March 6th or 7th. So it was right before this. We had our USO Radiothon on the 6th to raise money for the USO. And then the 7th, I did an event with Mark Levin, great radio host, the great one. And the first question I asked him was, do you think, are we becoming more like subjects than citizens? You know, we have to answer everything to the government, where everything requires permits and fees and you know, to cut hair needs a license. And then they can threaten to take that license away if you want to open your business during a pandemic. Is it more and more that we, the people, have become we the subjects? And I like that you touch on that. I like that you're not afraid to go there.
Oh yeah, no, that's what's very personal to me. And I think that resonates with people, even if they're on the other side of the political spectrum. I think that people appreciate the honesty, the authenticity. Sometimes I get hit on reviews. Like, there's two types of reviews that are bad. And I love reading the bad reviews, actually, because they're kind of funny. And I do a thing on my Instagram where I read them and have a little comment, but I don't say the person's name. So I try to just, because I think they sell just as many books as the good ones. Because someone can write, oh, there's too much gear in the book. I don't need to know that he wore Solomon boots, which are clever. But somebody else is like, oh man, I love gear. I want to get this book. So I think it actually helps. But the bad reviews usually say something about too much gear, or you know, too much weapons stuff, or something about right-wing conspiracy type thing, blah, blah, blah. But in real life, you know, people don't just go through life not taking a stand or not having a thought about taking a stand, not having, you know, so to write something so bland, I couldn't do it. Like, it just doesn't seem right to me to try to appease everybody and not want to piss off one side or another. It's just going to be honest writing. And some of the stuff is what I believe, but then sometimes another character is just a character. And that's what that character believes. And it has nothing to do with what I believe, but it's just another character in the book. But it's interesting that that some people take issue with that. And that's fine. But it's just kind of how it's going to be. Because I think trying to write something that didn't mention either political party and just kind of went down the middle of the road and had a protagonist that didn't stand strong for something, for principles. And really the first book is all about the protagonist abandoning some of those principles.
Right.
Becoming the terrorist, so it really explores that through his eyes, abandoning those things that he fought for at that time, the last 16 years at war, now longer. But so for me, it's just natural to write. Mm-hmm. I think that comes off to the reader. And you know, if they don't, they agree or disagree, it's natural for me to do that, and it's authentic, and that really resonates.
Jack Carr, by the way, you can get his book right now. There's a link. You click it. Jack will get you a signed plate and get the book, Savage Son. The question from Shannon on Facebook. You can ask a question, by the way. Shannon says, do I have to read the other books before I read this one? What do you think about that, Jack?
Yes. So the publisher would love me to say no. You just jump in with
this grab latest, it. Right,
yeah,
right.
Got the latest one. I do that too. If I discover a series like five books in or six books in, sometimes I do that just because it's there, or a friend recommended it, or I'm going through the airport and I always wanted to read something by that author and I grab it. But then I go back to the beginning and I start there. So if you can't, and this, there's only three books. So starting from the beginning, I think is the best way to go.
Yeah. Because
you invest in the characters, you understand where they're coming. And I do, in the other books, you know, you do a little background and catch people up that haven't read those. But I think it'll be a better experience for the reader to start with the first one, then move to True Believer, and then into Savage Son. But Savage Son is the one I wanted to write first. When I wrote down six or seven different ideas on the table and had to decide which one to go with, it was very obvious that the characters weren't quite to the place where I could explore the dark side of man through the dynamic of hunter and hunted, which is what Savage Son really explores. I had to get them to that stage first. And it was very evident that, okay, the Terminalist has to be the one, because that's so primal, so visceral, so hard-hitting. That's the way I need to come out of the gate. And I think that's the one that's most likely to be recognized by a New York publisher as well. But Savage Son is the one I've wanted to write since sixth grade. And yeah. When I first read The Most Dangerous Game by Richard Connell, which is a 1924 short story, this is really that tribute to that short story. And I always knew back then that one day I'd write a tribute to that short story, and Savage Son is it.
When we first met, Jack, was when True Believer came out, and I got an email from your publisher saying, hey, would you like this guy on, Navy SEAL? And I thought, yeah, I like this guy. There's something about you. I don't know. It's just like, I thought, I'm going to get in on the early stages of Jack Carr. Like, I'm going to buy the stock cheap. You know what I mean? Because you're going to be, I have no doubts, you're going to be as big as all the big Brad Thor, Nelson DeMille. I mean, Tom Clancy, that's where you are. You're there. And so I saw this book. I said to my producer, Greg, I said, Greg, let's get this guy on. I want to read the book. And I started to read it. And then immediately I stopped and said, hang on, I'm going to go buy Terminalist on Amazon on my Kindle so I can read that first. And thank God I did. Like, I'm so glad I did, because that the reason why James Reese feels the way he feels, I mean, you so vividly, graphically, violently portray it. And you just, I was blown away. I read this. I was like, oh my God, thank God I'm reading this part first, you know?
Nice. And yeah, the second one I knew, I also wanted to, take a bit of a risk, because I didn't want to be looked at as a one-trick pony and really just pick up the revenge theme that worked so well in the first book and then just drop it into Africa, into Europe, into China, into, like, just drop it at different places around the world but kind of do the same thing. I wanted to push it, and I thought it would be disingenuous to the reader to have the main character, James Reese, just all of a sudden start down this other story without having a period of transition, without learning to live again after the traumatic events of the first book. Because everyone goes through, and I think it worked, because everyone in life goes through transitions. It could be a divorce, could be changing jobs, could be the death of a loved one, whatever it is, like, you're gonna get knocked down in life. Doesn't matter. That's what really connects all of us, is we're gonna get knocked down. And what really defines our character is how we get back up. Not just that we get back up, but how we get back up.
Yeah.
And so I didn't want to just finish the book, first book, and then jump right into action on the second. He had to go on this journey and had to learn to live again, had to find that next mission, find that next purpose, which all of us that make transitions have to do. And my background is just from special operations. So that's what I drew upon when I thought about transitioning into a new phase of life. And I saw a lot of people have a hard time with that over my last couple of years in, when I knew I was getting out and started to watch others make that transition. And then being here in Park City, Utah, you see it with Olympic athletes that have been so focused on a certain sport for so long, then all of a sudden they're not Olympic athletes or they're not going to compete anymore. Right. They have to move on to something else. Same thing with professional athletes, that sort of thing. But the second one does take a little while to get going because he has to go on that journey and because he has to find that next mission in life and that purpose. But it worked because everyone goes through that at some point. So it's something that we all share. And then the action takes off from there. So, but I do think they're good to read in order to be a better experience.
You talk a lot about the 80s, and are there any movies that particularly influenced you? Outlaw Josie Wales, for example, any kind of those genre of movies?
So I came of age probably kind of the first kind of more adult type action movie I remember that really made an impact on me. I mean, see The Longest Day, I see those ones with my dad early on. So those Westerns that he liked, those World War II movies that he liked, like The Great Escape,
Dirty Dozen,
those Westerns like Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, Wild Bunch, True Grit, those types of movies. So I watched what he liked to watch probably in the 70s and early 80s. But then as we transition into the 80s and there's a kind of a shift in culture and in movie making as well, I just obviously gravitated towards things that I wanted to do one day. So Uncommon Valor with Gene Hackman stars a young Patrick Swayze as well. Love that movie because right at that time I'm reading a book by J.C. Pollock called Mission MIA about these guys that 10, 12 years after the war go back to Vietnam to get the guys out. Of course, there's the Chuck Norris movies that have the same theme. There's the Rambo movie that has the same theme. But I got to see a little bit of Uncommon Valor being filmed in Hawaii when I was a kid. So I was enamored with that. And then to see it after seeing it being filmed, seeing that on the screen. So loved all those movies in the 80s. Magnum, of course, had a huge impact on me. And that's really when I thought of developing this character and creating this character. Like everyone loved Magnum. Guys loved him, girls loved him, everybody loved Magnum in the 80s. Tom Selleck did a fantastic job. And it's really the first show that dealt with PTSD in a serious way. Mm-hmm. And it worked for that show. And I thought of how, especially in one episode, Did You See the Sunrise, how Magnum, and it also deals with him and his friends being POWs in Vietnam and the person who held them captive coming to Hawaii, and is there conspiracy involved and all that stuff. But one of Magnum's friends is killed. And at the end, it's the first time in television history that a protagonist has killed an unarmed man. And it's in prime time. And it was a surprise to everyone, to the audience. It was a fight to get that made, to have that ending. And it went down in television history as one of the best endings to a TV show ever. Magnum turns around with his 45, just boom, just shoots this guy. And that's where it freeze frames right there. And it's totally silent after the shot goes. But people could forgive a protagonist back then for doing that because they liked him. They were invested in the character. They love Magnum. They love the show. So when he does that, then they're still on his side. And I knew I needed that. So that's all those shows during those formative years, everything I read, all the movies I watched, the TV shows I watched, the things I did physically outside, even though then I was preparing for my future, trail running and doing all these things. But all that impacted me, and it comes out in the novels. And I do drop those little Easter eggs in there for people that kind of grew up in that same time frame, so they have something to look forward to as well, or try to find in those pages.
I think it's really kismet that this is going to be an Amazon series for your books, because we're home now, and movies, I'm sure everybody has the dream of a movie, right? Like, I'm going to have a movie made about my book. But I think this is 1,000 times better, because first of all, the quality of these TV shows today that they're making, I mean, I thought they did a great job with Jack Ryan. Just thought they did a terrific job with the storytelling, and it was just so well done. So that's the thing, is that they want to make these top-notch, super quality, and people are going to be home now and watching this stuff and being able to absorb it and tell their friends about it. It's really like, I mean, talk about perfect timing for an Amazon series to be launched, right?
Yep, no, I think so. And of course, when you're writing it, you're thinking movie, but then when the book came out, I thought, you know what, this would be such... You can only tell this through a series, and Amazon would be the perfect place because of the connection to books and just how you can tie that all in. And when the Jack Ryan stuff comes out, for months, I was getting packaging tape from Amazon that had Jack Ryan across.
Yeah, right.
So it just makes it easy, I think, for people to then go, oh, this is a book. Oh, it's Amazon. Here, click here. So I think it's a good way to go, and it's the best way to go to tell this story. I think packing it into an hour and a half would be difficult. And they did such a fantastic job with the Bosch series, Michael Connelly's series with Harry Bosch. Like, that's fantastic for people who have not seen that. And this is the way to go with these kind of stories. But book adaptations, I think, lend themselves particularly well to a series like this. So I could not be more pleased. It's a fantastic place, and the team they put together is just top notch.
I'm a guy, I love movies, and I love television shows. For me, I love being absorbed in that. And a lot of times my audience, conservative talk radio listeners, for example, they hate Hollywood. They despise Hollywood. They don't, I don't want to watch anything Holly weird. I don't want anything to do with them. And I always try to tell people, you know, there's a lot of people working on these shows. They're not millionaires. You know, they're the guys, the key grips and the caterers and the people building the sets and everything like that. It's a huge part of our economy that puts a lot of food on the table for people. You're dealing with a guy who's got very strong beliefs, Chris Pratt, who's just an awesome guy. Do you find that struggle though? I mean, now that you're in this world of Hollywood, I mean, for better, lack of a better term, I guess we'll just call it that, right? So now that you're in that world, what is that struggle like for you?
No, I haven't changed anything. I am typically very honest with everyone. My wife out there, I'm the worst liar in the world. You know, I can't do it. It doesn't work. It doesn't work for me. I haven't had to shift anything. I try to be thoughtful regardless. And so when I present things or I'm talking about hunting or tactical shooting or being prepared or things that are important to me like that, I think that so far anyway, just the way that I present it has not caused an issue. Like, hey, this guy's thoughtful about what he does. I might not agree with it, but it, at least he's thoughtful. He's passionate about it. And so I think that, I guess that helps. I'm not sure, but I haven't changed anything. No one's asked me to change anything. I see some reviews where people will say, oh, I hope his publisher doesn't direct him to do, you know, to lighten this up or whatever. And they have never given me any sort of direction on that as far as politics or hey, maybe you should write more for this other crowd to bring this other crowd in. Never have they said one, even mentioned anything like that. So I have complete freedom there. I haven't really experienced that in Hollywood yet. We'll see. I mean, we did the writer's room thing, and I would suspect that many of them are not conservative, but you know, we didn't talk about that. We just talked about what we're all passionate about, which is making this the best series it can possibly be, keeping it raw, keeping it authentic, keeping it as real as we possibly can. And I'm holding up guns on that because we're doing it remotely, you know, holding up pistols here on the screen. Maybe it's the first time you've ever seen a real one, I don't know. But, you know, it's kind of fascinating. And we all have a common goal of making this as good as it can possibly be. So it's fun. So it hasn't been an issue yet at all.
That's awesome. That's really, all right, we got a couple questions here. So our sponsor tonight, Malamud Law, they have a question. Malamud Associates, Attorneys at Law, LLC. So grateful to them for sponsoring this event with Jack Carr tonight. I know the answer to this. Is there anything during the pandemic that has inspired future writing? So I guess now is a good time. Let's talk about book number four.
Yeah, book number four. So I was just downstairs and part of that research and that, I was like, is that my house or yours?
That's my baby crying.
I love it. That's how it goes. Great. All this humanizes us too. I think it's so great.
I'm looking, my wife's in there with the baby and I'm thinking maybe she thinks it's a soundproof in here. I don't know. Everything okay? We're good. Okay, we're good. All right.
Love it. Sorry, what was your question again?
Sorry. I know, right? Exactly. So the new book, is there anything during the pandemic that has inspired your future writings? And this is probably a good time to talk about book number four.
Yeah, so book number four. So before I get to that, I think in thinking about it, I was just downstairs and writing before I came up here. And there's a section in the book that goes back to 9/11, to that day. And so I'm calling friends that worked in New York that were on Wall Street at the time, asking them, you know, what their experience was on that day, what restaurants were open, you know, what streets could you see the planes come in from, and like all that stuff from their experience. What did it sound like? Could you hear it if you were in this building? How about on this street? So I'm getting all those that information from people that were there. And even all these years later, it was so amazing just how much emotion came out in their voice, because they weren't, it was the people that they knew. And I found out that one of them was on the phone with somebody at Cantor Fitzgerald at the time when it went dead. It just amazing stuff. So that's weaving its way into this fourth novel as well. But the fourth one, I talked about the themes for the first one. The first one was really a story of revenge without constraint. Second one is a story of violent redemption. third one is explores the dark side of man through the hunter-hunted dynamic. And this fourth one really explores the legality, the ethics and morals behind targeted assassinations. So that's what the protagonist needs to wrestle with. Now that he knows he's not dying, he's moving into this next phase of his life. There's still a couple loose ends to tie up from the first three books where he needs the United States government intelligence apparatus to track a couple people down. So that's where we find the protagonist there. So that's really the theme, but that it's not, can't just be about a theme. There's gotta be something to overcome, of course, in a novel. And I started to do research into infectious diseases and to the weaponization of infectious diseases well before the pandemic hit. So when it did hit, I was hypersensitive to it because I'd been, of course, bioweapons have been around for essentially since the beginning of time, but my research focuses on what the Japanese did in the lead up to World War II, and then during World War II, how they used those bioweapons against the Chinese, and then after the war, what happened to all that data, all that research, all the notes that were taken from how they used it practically in World War II, then the Soviet weapon program from the end of World War II up to the fall, and then what happened to that program, what happened to that information, what happened to that data, what happened to those researchers, and then our weapons program from the end of World War II up to today. So I was researching all that. I was very in tune with how that comes into play. Some of the things that happened in the Soviet Union where some of those infectious diseases escaped from their bio labs and had killed a few people. Of course, it was hush-hushed in the Soviet Union back in the day because they could do that. So there was precedent for that happening today where people ask me about China and Wuhan and all that sort of thing. I think, well, in my research, that there's precedent for that happening in the Soviet Union. And in some of these places, they don't quite have the protocols in place like we do in the United States. So that's the fourth one, really exploring targeted assassinations, which is more closely associated with Israel than it is with us, even though we do it as well. The Soleimani hit in early January as the most recent example. And who knows, we're probably doing it tonight. There's probably a group of guys out there tonight getting ready to go out and hit a target somewhere. And that's really what the fourth one dives into. So super excited about it. And these last few months, of course, launching the third book in the middle of a pandemic was crazy. So now it's time to shift gears and dive back into book four. And that'll probably be done mid-summer and then start the editing process.
This is probably a good time for me to ask you, how many confirmed kills do you have?
That's only amateurs. Not confirmed kills.
I ask you this every time, so I had to do it. I had to try to get it out of you.
Yeah. Maybe I'll slip up one day.
But I'm glad you're going to explore that because I think that's obviously, again, that struggle of all the questions around that and the morality of the humanity of all that. But you know, you are such a thoughtful person, and then translating that into your characters in the book, which is really, really key. This pandemic is interesting from a perspective of biowarfare, because I was saying early on in March, I was out to dinner with some friends, and one of them who's a CEO of a hospital, and we were saying, you know, if this was a virus that was launched on purpose, like if this was a biowarfare, it's kind of a really unique weapon because it doesn't kill a lot of people, but it does get enough people sick that you could cripple economies, you know? And then you could have a country kind of take over that way versus having to have a lot of kills. You know, you just cripple economies around the world, and then they can rise up out of the ashes of it. I think about that. I think about Clancy's writings in terms of looking at, you know, Red Storm Rising and looking at all that. I mean, clearly, China is not our friend, right? I mean, it's. I feel like we're dealing with. We grew up in the 80s. We had the Wolverines. I mean, we had Red Dawn, right? So, but now it's kind of like we're dealing with this big country, China, that it's hard to trust. I don't trust any of the numbers that come out of that country. I don't really trust them in any way, shape, or form. And I mean, is it that out of their own possibility that if not them, then somebody else then would then take a virus that is like this virus and then say, you know what, we can unleash it. Because if the goal necessarily may not want to be to kill a lot of people, right? Because you want people to just be weak and then buy your stuff, right? China still wants us to buy all their goods on Amazon, right? So they don't want to kill a lot of people. Is that kind of a thinking for you in terms of that? Of like what the enemy is thinking when they take over? Like what's their grand plan in life, in the world, in the next 10 years, 50 years, that sort of thing?
Yeah, so now I get to explore all these things through the medium of commercial fiction, which gives me time to think it all through, fictionalize it. So it's fascinating for me, and I absolutely love every part of it. But this pandemic in particular, I get asked Do you think China released this on purpose? And, you know, my answer is no, because when you're weaponizing a virus, when you're weaponizing a contagious infectious disease, you don't want it to turn into a pandemic. You want to focus it on a certain geographical location, have it burn out before it gets back to the country that launched it. You don't want it to kill everybody. So I think it's highly likely that they're doing research in those labs and that maybe it got out that way. But as far as it being intentional release of a weapon, it doesn't fit with the research that I've done into infectious diseases and to weaponizing those infectious diseases.
Right.
But the enemy's always watching. And that's one of the things, even though I was already going down this path of a bioweapon for the fourth book, what I'm incorporating from our current pandemic and our government's response to it is exactly that. Is that response and what that's done to our economy. And I'm not the only one doing that. I'm not the only one taking these notes. The enemy is doing that as well.
Sure.
They're always taking notes. They're always learning. They're always adapting, just like we are doing and should be doing to them. But with China, with Russia, with Iran, with North Korea, those countries in particular are taking notes and they're incorporating what they're learning from our response to this pandemic into future battle plans. I should say possible future battle plans, but they are taking those lessons in an academic sense and applying them to those battle plans. That is 100% happening. Will they act on those ever? Who knows? Could they do it tomorrow? Probably not. Maybe next year, the year after, who knows? 50 years from now, maybe. But it's in there. They're thinking about it. They're adapting. They're applying those lessons. And if you remember, we had a distinct shift in how we talked about China, how we talked about Russia in the early 90s. We talked about them after the fall of the Soviet Union as strategic partners. Well, they've never really taken that to heart. They have continually looked at us as the enemy. Whereas us, precision in language reflects precision in thought. And in this case, when we start saying strategic partner over and over and over again about countries that are enemies of ours, for a lot of the populace, that just by its very nature becomes, oh, strategic partners. They're not bad. They wouldn't do this. They wouldn't do that. Well, better take a breath. They might not be looking at us as strategic partners. They might be looking at us as an enemy, as an adversary, and they're taking notes on how to do us harm.
I've got a question from Scott. Did you work with the Northern Alliance after 9/11?
No, so I got there in 2003 was my first time in there. So some guys went in right away, Johnny Michael Spann, the first CIA, the first casualty in the War on Terror from the CIA. He was up there working with those guys. Triple Nickel, if you read the book Horse Soldiers or saw the movie, those guys were in first. Some guys on the Naval Special Warfare side also for a different mission. But so I didn't get to work with the Northern Alliance. Mostly the early guys in 2001, early 2002 were the guys that did that.
Does the show, I've got a question from Bob. Does the show SEAL Team accurately portray the SEALs?
They do a great job. So one of my buddies is one of the guys that created it, Marco, and the guy that wrote No Easy Day. And he said, hey, there's a show coming out. Tell me what you think. And in my mind, I'm like, oh, geez, what if I hate it? Like, I'm probably not going to like this, but I got to watch it because he's such a good buddy. And I was like, all right. And I watched it and I was like, oh my gosh, they did a fantastic job. They did a really good job portraying these relationships, internal and with the families. They get a lot of the gear right. They're moving really well together. So they do a really good job on all aspects of that show. And now I know most of the guys on it, and they're all fantastic guys. They're all connected to the veteran community. They're all, and they have actual veterans. They have over 150 veterans working on the show in some way, shape, or form, whether it's someone with doing the lights, doing, you know, whatever. People are learning those trades as they transition out of the military, and over 150 of them are doing it on that set. And then they also have guys as part of the cast. Tyler Gray, former Delta guy, is one of the cast members. And I think that helps so much because it's not just some technical advisor on the side looking, getting distracted by something over here. Like, no, your buddy is gonna call you and tell you what was that in the show.
Right.
And so you're more invested in it. If your friends are going to call you and make fun of you for something they see in the show, knowing that you're there, and yeah, you're an actor, but you're really a technical advisor also, just because you're there in the gear and you live that life for so long. So I don't think any other show does it like that. And they do a fantastic job.
Another question here. How long does Jack have to submit manuscripts for?
Yeah, we hit that one. So I don't think I'm doing it again after that last note back saying they didn't even want to see the appeal. So I think that that note I'll take as they don't want me bothering them anymore and want to put them up. So, okay.
How many deployments did you do, Jack? Scott on Facebook wants to know that.
Yeah, 7. One pre-September 11th, so I saw a little bit of that world. And then 2 weeks into my second deployment was September 11th. Mm. And we're in Guam at the time, and it was like midnight there, and phones start ringing up and down the hallways, and people start banging on doors, waking people up. And then we had one TV in the basement of the barracks. I was enlisted at the time. And we went down to those barracks, and we watched the Twin Towers fall on TV. So, and then after that, it was... I won't say chaos, but there was a lot of uncertainty. No one really knew what was going on, what our response was going to be. We all thought we were going to go right to Afghanistan. And then a few days later, we were on planes to the Middle East, and we ended up not going to Afghanistan. We took over for SEAL Team 3, who was doing shipboardings in the Gulf to enforce the UN embargo against Iraq. And those guys went in. So that was kind of my first post-September 11th time in the military. So it was a good run. But also when I got back from my last one, when I was then a lieutenant commander, which is a troop commander, and which is like a major in the other services, it was very evident that it was now time to get out and take care of my family. It was a solid run, but I came in enlisted because I wanted to learn the trade. I wanted to be a sniper. I wanted to kick those doors in, establish a reputation, learn that trade. I didn't want to be one of the, once again, the power of 80s fiction and television and movies was that they always had a brand new officer show up in Vietnam and tell the guys to shave, to start saluting, iron their uniforms, and then he would lead them immediately right into an ambush. Like that's how it went in all those movies. And I'm like, I do not want to be that guy. I'm not doing that. So I wanted to go in enlisted first. But so after my last deployment, really in today's military, at that 04 level, that major lieutenant command level, lieutenant commander level, that's the last time you're going to tactically lead guys on the battlefield. After that, you come back as a commander of a team, and you're an 05, so you're a commander in the Navy, you're a lieutenant colonel in the other services, and you're back in that tactical operations center. You're back there looking at those computer screens with the predator feeds and all the rest of it, and you're not out there making the calls on the ground, kicking those doors, doing that sort of thing with the guys. So once I got back from that last deployment as an 04 troop commander, it was time to get out and take care of the family. That's when I shifted gears and started thinking about that transition.
I think about, we talked the first time we hung out together about what it was like, you know, going through SEAL training. And so I want to ask you about a comment you made, which is, don't quit today, quit tomorrow, right? That was one of those sayings, right?
I think I was talking about a friend. Everybody has a different way they make it through. And mine, I talked about earlier about thinking about all those people that sacrificed so much so I could be there. But a buddy of mine, he was like, you know what? I'm not going to quit till that guy quits. And that guy would quit. And then he'd pick somebody new. And he'd say, I'm not going to quit till that guy picked. But that guy would quit. Then he'd just keep picking somebody so he'd know that he'd get down. He'd be the last guy if he quit at all. But that seemed to work for him. So, and typically what makes the most sense and what the advice most people give is, hey, take it one evolution at a time. A lot of people say take it one meal at a time. I say take it one evolution at a time, meaning, hey, we're doing log PT now. Okay, then we're moving to the obstacle course. Get through that. Okay, then we're going to lunch. Okay, got through that. Now we're doing a swim. Okay, got through that. Just do them one at a time instead of thinking, how many of these do I have to do by Friday? What are we gonna be doing tomorrow night? I heard that's the hardest night of Hell Week. Like, if you're thinking like that, your mind's in the wrong spot. Think about crushing the evolution right here in front of you and moving on to that next one. So if you think too far ahead, especially in Hell Week, it doesn't typically work out very well for you.
I mean, some of the SEALs, like Jocko's a great example, right? Like, so they've taken that and they've tried to turn it into life lessons for people, a motivation, inspiration, and getting on with things and moving on. Have you ever thought about that, writing a book like that, doing something more in that vein at some point, maybe in addition to this?
Not really. I mean, I do some public speaking every now and again where I talk about leadership and team building. Much prefer conversations like this. I think that's probably the way I'll go more in the future, because you just show up and have a great conversation. I'm much more comfortable doing that personally. If I do write nonfiction, it won't be in that vein of here are my leadership lessons, here's what I learned, here's how you can apply them to business. That's not the way I'll go. If I do a nonfiction, it will be something about this journey and the adversity that we faced along the way as a family. We have a middle child with severe special needs who needs 24/7 full-time care forever. So have we dealt with that as a family?
Yeah. You
know, how has that made us stronger, more loving, compassionate people? Like that part of it. Or, hey, do you know the odds of making it through SEAL training? Like, how did you get there? Or how did you, do you know the odds of getting published by Simon & Schuster? I get asked that one all the time. And I say, no, I have no idea because I didn't waste any bandwidth thinking about that. I know that it's hard and that's all I needed to know. I'm not really a numbers guy, but all that bandwidth needed to be focused on making it the best book it could possibly be. Like, that's where the bandwidth needs to go. Like, if you're worried about how hard it is to get through BUDS, well, you know, that's bandwidth that you're not training. You're not out doing pull-ups. You're not sprinting those hills. You're not reading something that's going to make you a better operator. Same thing with writing or with anything you want to do in life that's hard to do. And typically those things that are tough to do, you get a lot of naysayers telling you about how hard they are. And maybe they failed at it, or maybe they didn't even try. But they don't want to see somebody else they know succeed. So I didn't really pay any attention to those. I just let that kind of go. And you have to. And you just focus all your energies where they need to go, where they're going to be most productively spent. Because you only have so much bandwidth. We only have so much time. That's our most valuable asset. If you're worried about how hard it is, or think, oh, I'm never going to get published, that's just too hard. Hardly, there's like, I don't even know what the percentage is, but let's say it's 1% of people that submit get, well, that, don't waste your time there. Make your book great. Like, that's what you need to be doing, making it as good as it can possibly be. So I have this little saying, never tell me the odds. I think I got it from Star Wars or Empire Strikes
Back. I was going to say, right? Isn't that the Han Solo?
In the asteroid field, exactly.
Yeah, so never tell me the odds.
Yeah. I just love that. Never tell me the odds. Don't pay attention to the odds, because people are going to tell you. Like, you even have to ask them not to. So it's not really don't tell me the odds. It's don't pay attention to those odds, because people are going to tell you, and they're going to love to tell you how hard it is to be a SEAL and how hard it is to get published. Or if you want to do something else, like play in the NFL or play in the NBA, plenty of people are going to tell you how hard that is. Okay, great. Now get after it, train and go for it. Like, that's what it's all about. But don't waste bandwidth just focused on how hard it is, or getting discouraged by people who want to tell you how hard it is.
Yeah, I think back to when I was getting started in radio, and so many people.
Oh yeah, so many people probably told you how hard that is. How many?
Yeah, everybody. You're not going to make it. You're wasting your time. The industry's dead. What are you doing? You know, and I would do night shifts and holidays and double shifts, and you know, the day after Christmas morning, I'd leave vacation to do a show. Whatever I could do, I just did it. And there were people who would say to me all the time, you know, really, the odds of this, the odds of you succeeding, or, you know, I would just always say the same thing. Like, what I'm concerned about now is becoming a good talk show host. I'll figure that stuff out later. But first, I got to be a good talk show host. Then I'll figure that out. And I think that applies a lot in things in life, right? We're trying to climb a mountain, but we forget about just even knowing, like, how to get your gear together. It's the Abe Lincoln thing of, if I'm going to spend 4 hours cutting down a tree, I'm going to spend 3 hours sharpening the blade, you know, before I do that. It's that you want to write a book. I think about it from the sense of, just start writing a book, like, just write a book, just do that and worry about the other stuff later. But I feel like that's, that can cross into so many other areas of our life, right? You want a good marriage, just be a good husband, like, try to do things, take it sort of baby steps a little bit.
Oh yeah. There'll be no shortage of people telling you how hard it is or how impossible it is. For whatever reason, people love to do it. I think those are the same people that leave negative reviews, mean-spirited reviews. Those are the same ones. I think that's the same guy. Because people do take some serious time writing those things. Like, it's like, they put a lot of energy into that.
Yeah.
Like, personal attack and, like, oh, you know, horrible and gear and this and whatever it is. And, like, if they had taken that energy and applied it, like, to something that they want to do or they're passionate about. But then again, maybe they're passionate about leaving bad reviews. I don't know.
maybe that makes them happy, you know?
But there'll be no shortage of people that are going to tell you how hard it is or how impossible it is. And, I think the trick, although it's not really a trick, is just, thank you very much and move on with your day and get out there and do everything you can to make that dream come true, or to be prepared for that door to crack open when that opportunity presents itself, so you're ready. You're ready to crush it. So, but that takes work. So, if I do write, that was a long way of saying, I think if I do write some nonfiction stuff, it'll be more in the vein of what Stephen Pressfield did on his books on creativity, War of Art, Authentic Swing, Turning Pro, do the work. It'll be something along those lines, but that talk, I actually have a couple outlined over there on my little board, cool. But that talk about that journey, but they're thin, that that can help inspire people. Because really what I do is, yeah, I have a product that's a book, but also I want to share this journey with people so that people realize that they can do it too. You can just, whatever you aspire to, like, you can do it. It's not going to happen for you. No one's going to do it for you. You have to do the work. No one's going to hand it to you. No matter how much money you have, no matter what your background is, it doesn't matter at all. Like, you've got to get out there and get after it. That's what you have to do.
And it was really important for you to write the books yourself. Your journey as an author, from Terminalist to Savage Son, do you feel, and of course, you know, between rewrites and drafts and stuff that probably never got written because you deleted it and stuff, your journey as an author, what's that like from your first book, second book, to the third book?
Yeah, so once again, back to the work, putting in the work. I think people can read a lot about how to do something, and everybody's gonna have a different point at where they have to put those books down, stop researching it online, stop watching the master classes. All those are fantastic. And actually,
are they? Do you recommend those? Are they good?
I did one, and it was really good. I watched. Who did I watch? Now I can't even think of who I watched. But yes, they are good. We got it at the beginning of this pandemic when we're on lockdown. So I did one. I didn't make it all the way through, but they're good. I had to get back to work actually writing the book, but they have some really fascinating ones, like negotiation ones. Like, my wife's trying to watch one of, like, a gardening thing she's trying to do, but kids, it's also hard to do with the kiddos out there.
Right.
But so you can almost study how to do something too much. So I read those Stephen Pressfield books, read them all once. And then I had them within sight of me as I was writing. And they're really about creativity. He calls it slaying resistance, which really means just sit down and do the work. Don't get, don't let that distraction come in and derail you. That's really what they all say. I read On Writing by Stephen King. I read The Successful Novelist by David Morrell. I read Jean Le Carré's The Pigeon Tunnel, which is a story really of his life. So I read those and I was like, okay, good. Got it. Boom. You got to write it. Like, that's what it says. You got to sit down and write. So that's really what I did on that front. So the journey of an author as an author started probably with my mom reading to me when I was a kid some book I don't even remember, moving up and reading some of the things I do remember, like My Side of the Mountain, amazing book that I remember from back in the day. And then moving on to reading my own young adult stuff and reading like some Farley Mowat stuff, reading those kind of books, and then moving into what my parents were reading Tom Clancy, reading all those guys in the 80s that the same ones my parents were. And that really became my formative education in that art of storytelling. So it started way back then. It doesn't have to start there for everybody, but mine did. And I think it was really, for me, it was reading those books during those times, like reading Hunt for Red October while we're still in the middle of the Cold War. You know, reading The Charm School during those times.
Great book.
During that lens, during that lens, especially for me as a kid in the 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th grade, it was a magical experience. So when I look back, I don't reread those books today because I'm worried they're going to have lost some of their magic. And now I have some filters and some cynicism and some experience and whatever else that I'm now applying to those pages that were written in 1983, 84, 85, 86, 87. So that was so, for me to read those during that time and to capture that magic, like, that's what I'm trying to capture today, is that magic, that heart. And I think that heart is really what makes these books stand out. And I think why they stood out to Simon & Schuster. So those emotions, those feelings, and that heart. So that journey as an author started way back then, added to it by the academic study of warfare, then the practical application of those experiences downrange also into the mix, then kind of reading about those books by Stephen Pressfield and Stephen King on how to do it. Okay, it wasn't really how, it was just kind of their journeys, a couple recommendations, boom, let's go, let's get this going. And I just wrote it, and it took about a year and a half. Then that door got cracked open for me by Brad Thor. Never be able to thank him enough for cracking that door open. And Simon & Schuster loved it immediately. And next thing you know, off to the races. But the other part of this is that I was going to always write two. So even if I didn't even know I needed an agent at the time. I was just thinking publisher. And thank goodness I didn't know about the agent, because I probably would have tried to find one and I might still be looking. I didn't go past those books and go into more of the how-to part, how to get published, because that worked out very well, actually. Yeah, I got it to, once I got it to Simon & Schuster, they loved it, but I was always going to write two. So before I submitted that first one, I was already on a plane to Mozambique to do the research for my second novel, True Believer, which also was inspired by some things that happened to me in Iraq in 2006 when I was working for the CIA. So I knew I needed to get boots on the ground in Mozambique. I needed to talk to people. I needed to see what was going on with the poaching situation. I needed to see what the Chinese influence was in both legal and illegal mines. I just needed to talk to those people to weave that flavor in. Now, both books didn't make it. Then I was going to reevaluate my life choices, but I was at least going to do two because John Grisham, his first book is A Time to Kill, and he could not give that book away. And
right.
That's arguably, I think it's his best book. I haven't read some of the more recent ones. I've been so busy, but when you're looking at that first 10 years, I love A Time to Kill, and he could not give it away. Then he writes The Firm. He doesn't let that dissuade him. He mm-hmm. goes out, he writes The Firm. That one takes off, New York Times bestseller, Tom Cruise stars in the movie. And then we get a John Grisham book every year since. We get The Client, we get The Pelican Brief, we get all these amazing Runaway Jury. And he's writing books, he's doing what he loves to do, and he's not in some cubicle practicing law. So I always remember that story. So I was always gonna write those two. And if the first one didn't make it, I wasn't gonna get discouraged. I was gonna plow forward with that second one. And I was all in.
Well, I'm so glad you did, man. The books are awesome. You're super talented. So excited for the Amazon show, the series that's going to come out. Chris Pratt's involvement. I mean, starring as James Reese. It's going to be awesome. Really excited for that. So best of luck with that. Again, I want to thank our sponsors tonight, Garden State Earthworks. They are the best. Drain your water away once and for all. Hardscaping. They did a beautiful job on my patio. GardenStateEarthworks.com. And our friends at Malamud & Associates, attorneys at law, great attorneys. They're there for you, dedicated, super friends of the show. They sponsor our studio. So please think about them if you need some legal help. And if you want to get a copy of Jack's book, Savage Son, or any of Jack's previous titles, do so through the Joseph Fox Bookshop. Books purchased through Joseph Fox will include a signed book plate. Visit foxbookshop.com. Jack Carr, my friend, thank you. God bless, brother. I mean, I'm so happy for your success. You're such a great guy. You deserve every single ounce of it. You're humble and kind and an inspirational kind of guy. So I really appreciate your time tonight, man.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on. I always love talking to you. So I'm going to try to make as many excuses as I possibly can to get on the show and talk to you just so we can catch up and hang out. And then when this is all over, I'll get out there and we'll have a beer together.
That'd be awesome. Oh, one last question. How many kills?
Once again, amateurs.
Jack Carr, everybody. Have a great night. Thank you for watching us. We'll see you soon.
Awesome, man.
All right. Good stuff.
You guys are clear. Great job.
Thank you so much. That was so cool. I love doing that stuff with you. It's such a pleasure. So thank you.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of four lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.